And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this cold morning. 29 degrees outside. Put on the coat, man. It's rather chilly out there. Hopefully we'll warm it up. We'll get up to around the mid 50s today. And joining me in studio for Greenside Up this morning, we have James Coover and Jesse Gilmore. Guys, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Yeah, see you too.
All right, well, we'll go ahead and start with Jesse today. And Jesse, a few things that you did want to talk about that you were kind of talking about off air. It's the holiday season, so maybe it's time to look at a few holiday things, like say your Christmas tree.
Yep, it is time to start looking into holiday horticulture. For a lot of people, that's going to be Christmas trees and poinsettias. There is also kind of a niche market for holly and for mistletoe, but the vast majority of holiday-based plants that are purchased are going to be either poinsettias or Christmas trees. Poinsettias are in the spurge family. What people think of as the flowers are actually modified leaves called bracts, and the tiny pollen sacs in the center are what are technically the flowers. Like a lot of plants in the spurge family, the poinsettia will release a milky sap if its stems or leaves are damaged. This causes mild dermatitis in people who are sensitive to latex because it actually does contain latex in it. So if you do have a latex sensitivity, it might not be the best idea to buy poinsettias, or if you do buy poinsettias, to make sure that they don't get damaged around the house if you have small kids or animals, in order to ensure that you don't have any adverse side effects from the plants that you buy. And on the topic of pets, there is a common belief that poinsettias are toxic to pets, and it leads a lot of people to kind of forego buying them during the holiday season. This is actually not the case. There's research that shows that it takes a lot of consumption before pets or small children will end up getting sick. It is better to play it safe and keep the plants out of the reach of small children or pets if you can help it. But in most cases, the potting media or soil that the plants are put in will be more, will have more adverse side effects if for some reason it got consumed by the animal or the small child than the poinsettia itself would. There are ways to keep poinsettias past the holiday season, and that is something that will probably be on a future Greenside Up talk in order to keep them blooming. It is a little bit tricky because poinsettias actually bloom in periods of low light. They are very photosensitive, and if they are exposed to too much light or sun, they will not start changing color like a lot of plants would. So it takes some special considerations to keep your poinsettias alive past the holiday season and blooming again from year to year. They are annuals typically. They won't last terribly long, but you can get them through June. My mom has had some success keeping some of my old poinsettias at least through my birthday. So
wow, that's pretty cool.
Yep. And there's a ton of different varieties. You can find colors. You can find white. You can find pink. You can find a deep scarlet red. There's variegated flowers, which have kind of a mix. One of the projects that I worked on when I was a student at K-State in greenhouse operations management was we were responsible for tracking data for new varieties, and the one I had was called Premium Ice Crystals, so I like that one a lot, and it's a very cool looking poinsettia variety, and I would definitely recommend it. But you basically have the pick of whatever type of look you want for your plant. It's a huge industry now. And you can typically find them at almost all garden centers in the area. I know Walmart's going to carry them. Any other nurseries like TLC and Independence or TLC is the only one that's coming to my mind off the top of my head, but almost all garden centers will carry them around this time.
There's also Green Acres, I think, here in Coffeyville that carries them as well. So lots of good places to get poinsettias.
Yep.
Also, I wanted to talk about Christmas trees. And, of course, you know, most places you can, you know, I mean, our artificial tree is what most people get, it seems like, nowadays. But if you're wanting to get an actual live Christmas tree, of course, there's some places that do sell them. But what would you say is some of the best types of Christmas trees?
So Christmas trees fall into one of three categories, and they're all going to be conifer trees. There's the pines, there's the firs, and there's the spruces. Pines are going to be very hard to find in Kansas because there is no native pine for the state of Kansas. We're the only state in the country without a native pine tree, which indicates that they don't do the best here. And the ones that do are not typically Christmas tree pines. So the vast majority of Christmas trees that you're going to find are firs or spruces, slightly more on firs than spruces. There are some techniques to keep the lifespan of your tree as long as possible. The first, obviously, is to cut it as close to the holiday season as possible, so that it is perkier, it has more water retained in its tissue, and it basically stays turgid longer, firm branches instead of saggy branches with dropping needles. Needles function a lot in the same way as deciduous trees with their leaves, in that they go through evapotranspiration, which is where water evaporates out of the leaves, and basically the plant loses water that way. And if you find that you're experiencing a lot of that, where your needles are starting to turn brown or droop or even fall off in really dry periods, increasing the humidity of the room that the tree is in will cause the water to evaporate out of the tree more slowly, and it will extend the lifespan of the tree that way. However, you're fighting a losing battle because you've basically cut it off from its water source in the roots. It will be a matter of time before the tree ends up dead. And once the needles start falling, you want to consider taking it outside, because sometimes insects are attracted to the dying wood and the sap in the tree. The sap is another thing to consider. All three of these trees have a very sticky sap through which nutrients typically flow when the tree is still in the ground. Creating the wound on the trunk will cause the sap to start leaking out of it. And so you do want to put some kind of protective barrier down on the floor underneath wherever you're going to put the Christmas tree. This could be carpet, this could be hardwood, but you definitely don't want a sappy mess to clean up after Christmas when you take the tree outside. You do have some options for what to do with the tree. I would absolutely recommend composting or using the needles as a mulch for any potential garden beds that you have, especially in vegetable gardens, because a lot of our soils are alkaline, and pine needle decay acidifies the soil. So it brings the pH down to a more tolerable range for most vegetables. It's not going to have a huge effect if you just do it once. But if you get a live tree year after year and continue to use the pine needles, you can see an effect that way. You could also put them in compost, but they do need to stay wet throughout the winter so that the bacteria that break down the compost continue to work. And then with the wood, you can use that in fire pits or fireplaces. One of the things that I think pine wood is really good for that not a lot of people actually use it for is smoking or barbecuing. It gives the meat a really good flavor. And you can also, and this is pretty niche, so I'm sure not a lot of people are going to be interested in this, but you can actually eat the inside bark of pine trees as an ingredient in certain recipes. So if you are interested in that, there's a lot of good recipes online for that, but it is incredibly niche. I think I'm the only person I've ever seen, even among foragers, who's actually used pine bark before.
Well, how's it taste, though? I mean, is it pretty good?
Oh, yeah. It's got it. I would equate it a lot to basically juniper as kind of a spice type thing. it tastes like it smells. And I know that's kind of a weird way to describe it, but that's the best way I can think of describing it.
Nothing wrong with that. Also, one more thing you were kind of spitballing at the break was fire pits versus fireplaces.
Oh, just using the wood as firewood, essentially. Okay. So, yeah, burning it. And it will give a very Christmassy smell to your house if you use it on in an indoor fireplace. That is probably, I think, the most natural way of using the Christmas tree once it's finally given up the ghost and basically died from lack of water and lack of nutrients as the sap slowly leaks out of the wound.
I like as there's a Christmassy smell to the house, which if people know pine trees, yeah, it's going to have a very nice smell to it. Most people like the smell of a pine tree, I would think. So they do have a very different odor to them. All right. And so do you have anything else for us?
Not right now, but okay. I will have some more stuff for you guys after the break on holiday horticulture and some things to watch out for.
All right. Well, we're going to go over to James here just for a moment. And James, before we get started, there it looks like we have a few programs that are that K-State is putting on.
Yeah. We tend to plug the programs every time we're on here. So go through real fast. The quickest one is actually November the 18th, so that's like next week, I think. And this will be pasture management and a producer round table. So basically, Walt Fick with K-State Extension, he's going to talk to us about taking care of your pasture, brush and weed control, fertilization, grazing management, and doing all that. And so we'll have places that will basically come together, and we can watch him virtually altogether. And so you can do that at the Crawford County Extension office. I think the Twin Valley Electric Co-op in Altamont, just kind of right there on the highway, and also in Caney, I believe. This one's not on my flyer, but Caney as well. Caney Ag. After that, there's going to be a state line COPS conference, and I've talked about this for a while now. It's been planned for a while. We're going to talk about the grain market update, the economics of soybean fungicides, but also after lunch, we're going to talk about tile drainage, which is kind of the keynote speaker for this. This will be a virtual conference on December the 2nd from 10 to 1 o'clock. And so, you know, give us a call and we can send you the link for you to get registered, which we'll give you a Zoom link, of course. And then after that, on December the 8th, will be a grain marketing workshop. This is a workshop that is specifically geared towards training people how to work the grain market to their advantage. It's a really intensive, hands-on workshop. We're hoping to have this in person with everything going on right now. It's, you know, maybe. But I'm still very hopeful that we can do this in person because that's really the only way to do this. And this will be at the Erie, Neosho County Fairgrounds. They got a brand new building there, and we'll get it all set up for that.
So. All right. So we're getting ready to take a break here in just a moment. But before we do that, James, just kind of preview what you're going to be talking about in the next segment.
I'm going to be talking about, well, I think I'm going to talk about fall soil sampling and also sampling for nematodes. Oddly enough, right now is a great time to sample for nematodes. Right after the soybeans come off the field is a good time to sample for those soybean cyst nematodes. And yeah, there's a lot of them out there. This is Southeast Kansas is really a hot zone for nematodes, so now's a good time.
All right, well, we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. We're going to go ahead and take our break right now. We got news coming up in just a moment, and then we'll get back to Greenside up on the other side of the break. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.
You can count on the Mighty 690 for severe weather coverage. When a storm is getting ready to blow in, we'll keep you up to date.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Mighty 690 KGGF. For Greenside Up, our second part of the show today, and in studio with us this morning is James Coover and Jesse Gilmore. We heard Jesse in the first part of our show. It's now time to get over to James Coover. And James, good morning. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing good.
All right. So what will be your subject that you'll be talking about today?
I'm going to talk a little bit about fall soil sampling. And while you're at it, you might as well sample for soybean cyst nematodes as well. And so now's a good time to test for pretty much anything involving soil. It's usually better to test for soil at one specific time during the year, and fall is a great time to do that before the ground freezes if it ever freezes here in the southeast. So this is kind of planning for next year. And so, because really, that's really the only thing going right now. Your wheat should have already been planted. It's a little bit different in dry soils. I don't know that our soils are so dry you're going to have an issue with it right now. Honestly, we might have just enough soil moisture to make it really easy to soil sample at this point. So it's still important, though, to get a 6-inch soil depth, even if the soil is a little bit dry underneath the surface. Getting that 6-inch soil depth, that's where all of our tests are calibrated to. And so if you're not getting that 6 inches, you're not getting a representative sample for the test. But there's a lot of, there are some minor aspects to this. For instance, potassium could be artificially lower with a fall soil sample test, because a lot of that potassium actually stays in the residue from year to year, and that residue hasn't had time to break down yet. And so you could have a slightly less than actual potassium value. It's just something to keep in mind. The low soil pH and the salts actually accumulate during years like this one, where it's been too dry and there hasn't been a whole lot of subsoil moisture movement. And so the salts actually accumulate in the surface of the soil. I mean, you've seen salt slicks and all that. It's a real big problem in the drier climates. And it can happen here during during dry years as well. And so the soil pH could actually just be a little bit lower than what it really would normally be. And so there are some minor aspects to keep in mind when doing your fall soil sampling. But besides that, now's a great time to do that. While you're doing your soil sampling, now would also be a great time to test for the soybean cyst nematode. And these are tiny little microscopic worms. They dig into the plant roots. There's actually some other nematodes that eat those nematodes.
The life cycle.
Yeah, the microbial world in the soils is really quite savage, really. It's a pretty mean place. And it's kind of crazy to think how many... There are tons of microbes per acre of soil. And so it's a huge world, and yeah, everybody's eating each other. And so the soybeans is nematode. Now's a good time right after soybean harvest, because you can get into the soybean fields and they're still around before the soil freezes. They can actually cause up to 40% loss within a field, usually within areas of a field. They actually tend to follow the river channels. And so you have an affected field, that field floods, the nematodes kind of go with the soil, it moves onto another field, and that's how they get infected. They also get nematodes moved by actually getting trapped onto the dirt of the combine tractors. And when the combines go from field to field, they get carried along within that combine. And so there's a lot of ways they can move, but really along the floodplains and the channels, those are really the fields are going to have some issues, especially the fields that are soybeans after soybeans after soybeans.
And that's so wild to think that something that small can destroy that much of a field. I mean, I know it's not just one doing it, but the fact something that small can destroy that much of a crop.
Yes. Yeah. They are very prolific. And so when these things get started, and if they have the cultural of constant soybeans, they're in the perfect environment to just explode in numbers. And so, their damage is hidden. You don't know that they're really there because they're tiny little microscopic under the soil and they're eating the roots. And so there's not really any specific plant symptoms make it obvious.
Yeah, that's not something you can just look at it and realize that it's happening underneath the soils they're destroying it at.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of other symptoms. And so it's really hard to tell that this is what the issue is. But if you have a low spot in your field that tends to have some issues, it doesn't seem to fit anything else. And honestly, if you've been doing soybeans, you know, time after time, and this, if there's other things make sense, you might as well test for nematodes. And so testing for them is a lot like soil sampling. It's a 6-inch deep soil sample. You probably want to take a few more cores, at least 15 is kind of the minimum, because there's a lot of variation. One soil sample might not get anything. Another soil sample might get a lot. And so of the little nematode eggs that they're testing for. And so you need to take more cores. You take the cores within the soybean row. And so the old soybean row, you take it inner row. And so that's the only difference, honestly, between testing for nematodes and testing for a soil sample is a few more cores and take it within the row. After that, it's really, you just kind of put it into a plastic bag, bring it to the office. Of course, this is a biological sample, so you cannot leave it out. If you do need to leave it overnight, put it in your refrigerator, but don't freeze it. Right now, we actually have a thing where they're doing a research project at K-State. So if you bring a nematode sample in now, we can send it off for free. And so it's kind of a good deal to, if you ever want to test for it, now's a good time because I have a whole bunch of bags. I need to know some research part things like the GPS coordinates and the variety and all that, do that free research thing. And so fixing a field after it's been, if it does have infected with nematodes, that's a little harder to do. How do you get rid of a tiny little microbe in this container, right, tiny little organism? And so, of course, you need to rotate out of soybeans for a while, or at least put some more stuff into the rotation so it's not soybeans after soybeans after soybeans. Because soybeans has nematodes, they kind of can feed in some other things, but really that's their main...
Soybeans is their go-to, basically.
Yes, that's their host. And so you take away their host, and they're going to have a hard time surviving. Oddly enough, they've done some research where they grow a mustard cover crop. And so, like, mustard as in, like, yellow mustard that you put on your hot dog.
Right.
It's the exact same mustard. And they grow that. The cover crop is actually the mustard grows in between the soybean seasons. And so then they till that stuff in before they plant soybeans. Well, that mustard actually emits a gas, the smell of mustard. It's like, I think it's glutathione sulfate or something like that. But anyways, that gas will, the nematodes can't stand it. And so it actually kills the nematodes.
Oh, nice.
And so it's a weird kind of coincidental biological control of these things. And it's surprisingly effective, too. There hasn't been a whole lot in the agronomic world done with that, but research has shown that it actually works pretty well. And so, I don't know, just kind of one of those things. There's nothing really else that you can take care of them, so you might
as well try it. Just do mustard. So.
Yeah, mustard.
Just do soybeans, then mustard, then, just go back and forth, basically.
Yeah, there's not a market for, mustard seeds, otherwise that would work pretty well. And so now's a good time to do that soil sampling in the fall, whether you're sampling your crops, your pastures, even your gardens, honestly. Anything is a good time to do some soil sampling. Soybean cyst nematodes while you're at it, if you got your soybean fields. And a lot of guys are still thinking about planting some late planted wheat as well. It's not entirely too late to plant some wheat. And so if you're thinking about planting some wheat after soybeans, I'd say, we've got some warmer soils now. Of course, you need to up that population percentage, but if you're interested in that, give the extension office a call and we got some publications for that. So,
all right, so lots of good stuff there. So, and if somebody did want to contact you, James, how can they get a hold of you?
I'm all over the place. The easiest place to call the Girard office, and that number is 620-724-8233.
All right, I'm going to come back to Jesse just real quick. Jesse, one thing that has always interested me since I was a kid is that, people talk about mistletoe, people like kiss under the... Did I hear right? That's actually a fungus, mistletoe is?
So, it's actually not a fungus, but it is a parasitic plant. So, it will attack other plants in order to remove the nutrients from them and basically nourish itself. It's a lot like another parasitic plant called dodder, which you see a lot more in... field crops. I don't think I've ever seen it in a garden or like produce vegetable garden type environment. But yeah, it basically kind of punctures the plant that it's choosing to be its host and then basically leaches out the nutrients.
Basically, it's attacking the plant is what it's doing.
Yep. Yes, it is. And I have no idea how this became a holiday tradition, but it is a very odd choice for plants, maybe, and I'm just spitballing here, I have no idea on the accuracy of this. They used it as a holiday decoration to keep other more desirable plants alive, and so... potentially what could happen is they create this tradition in order to keep people harvesting mistletoe and keeping other plants that people want more
beneficial plants,
yeah, alive by removing this parasitic plant. Although I cannot confirm any of that for certain. That would be my logic.
Yeah, and that would make sense because you're getting the mistletoe away from beneficial plants. That way they're not leaching off of those plants.
Yep.
All right, guys. Well, again, lots of great information. How can people get a hold of you, Jesse?
They can call the Girard office, too, 620-724-8233. If I'm not in the office, because I'm always driving around doing house calls and getting a look at people's trees, and it's almost always trees at this point, they can forward your call onto my cell phone. If I don't answer, I'm probably in a stakeholder visit or driving, so you can leave a voicemail on my cell phone whenever. Or alternatively, you could email me your questions at jr637@ksu.edu.
All right, and one more thing before we get out here. James, for people that maybe didn't hear at the start of the program, there are a couple of programs going on, and if you can go ahead and let us know about those programs.
Okay, I'll do them real fast. So the pasture management, and that will be on November the 18th. It'll be with Walt Fick talking about brush control, fertilization, grazing management of our pastures. We're meeting at... It can be at the Caney Ag Service, the Crawford County Extension Office, or the Twin Valley Electric Co-op. We'll just meet there in person, and we'll listen to Walt Fick virtually November the 18th at 6:45 p.m. The Grain or the State Lines Crop Conference, and this will also be virtual. We're not meeting anywhere. This will be at your house. So December the 2nd, 10 to 1, we'll talk about the grain market update. And we'll also talk about tile drainage on that as well. After that, December the 8th, we're going to have our in-person meeting. And this will be at the Crawford County Fairgrounds in Erie. It's a grain marketing workshop, so we're going to talk about grain markets, an actual hands-on workshop, talking about the market futures and how to get into that. That'll be December the 8th from 9:30 to 2:30.
All right, guys. Well, again, thank you so much for coming in today for Greenside Up, and we will see you guys next time.
Yep, thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we're going to start Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.
Need a better vehicle, but have bad credit? Roman Chevrolet Buick can and